Welcome to the Literature and Creative Writing Research Seminar. I am Veronica Alfano, and I just want to start by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the Macquarie University land, the Wallamattagal clan of the Darug Nation, whose cultures and customs have nurtured and continue to nurture this land since the Dreamtime. And we pay our respects to elders past and present. And I'll now introduce our speaker. Libby King is a PhD candidate here at Macquarie. Her research focuses on animals and memory in the writing of Mary Shelley and Mary Wollstonecraft. Her essay, Uncivil Usage, Shifting Forms of Control in the Tenant of Wildfell Hall, appears in the journal Victorians. Congratulations. And she has another article forthcoming in 18th Century Life. And her talk today is Human Forgetfulness and Animal Memories in Frankenstein and the Last Man. So over to you, Libby.
I just want to start out by saying that so this talk looks in part at memory and our sense of self as animals in time. And I just wanted to say it's a timely day to do it because yesterday was Mary Shelley's birthday and tomorrow is my birthday. All right. So the creature at the centre of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is not only made up of reanimated human corpses, but also the bodies of non-human animals. So although these animal components of the creature tend to be forgotten in our preoccupation with the rather more dramatic aspects of its makeup, the use of living animals in Victor Frankenstein's creation is referred to directly in the novel by Victor himself. Who shall conceive the horrors of my secret toil as I tortured the living animal to animate the lifeless clay? Now, while it is Victor Frankenstein who literally remembers the bodies of both human and non-human animals into not quite human form, I argue that it's the creature himself who remembers these animals through his consciousness. So Victor doesn't again refer to the non-human animals that he uses in his experiment, but in fact, his narration is characterized by a deliberately cultivated anthropocentric forgetfulness, not only of the being that he's created, but of all non-human animals that he encounters. And these animal bodies that are used and forgotten by Victor are remembered in the subjectivity of his creature. So even though he doesn't refer to them again, I suggest that the creature's own narration calls attention to a number of ways in which his point of view is informed by both the memories of both human and non-human animals that have formed part of his makeup. And so this is clear from the very beginning of his monologue. Describing his first moments of consciousness, he notes how a strange multiplicity of sensations seized me. I saw, felt, heard, and smelt at the same time. By degrees, a stronger light pressed upon my nerves so that I was obliged to shut my eyes. So in this early description, it's clear that the creature relies on other senses as much as vision. And in fact, his vision is not very strong and he's very sensitive to sunlight. So his visual experience of the world is very different to that of a fully sighted human being. And as the sunlight becomes more and more oppressive to the creature, he eventually falls into a deep sleep. When he wakes up, darkness has fallen, the moon has risen, and he is able to get up and go out in search of berries. His comfort in this night setting suggests a perspective at least partially informed by the bodies of nocturnal animals, and his subsequent description of the innumerable sounds that rung in my ears and the sense that on all sides saluted me evokes a multisensory awareness of the world in which both smell and sound are privileged as much as vision, capturing what the world might be like to an animal with a very different sensory makeup to humans. The creature's human animal subjectivity is also informed by the way that he's treated like an animal by the humans that he encounters. Over the course of his narrative, he's beaten with a stick and shot at by people who are afraid of his beastly appearance. And Victor himself refers to how the creature can be hunted at one stage in his narrative, like a wild antelope. So these animal memories that make up the creature's consciousness literally cut into the text of the novel to interrupt Victor's anthropocentric narrative. And this happens when Victor and the creature meet in the Valley of Chamonix. And just prior to this interruption, when they first meet, pretty much the first thing that Victor says to the creature is, cries, "Why do you call to my remembrance circumstances of which I shudder to reflect that I have been the miserable origin and author?" So here Shelley overtly draws attention to Victor's deliberate cultivation of an at times almost tyrannical forgetfulness. This is a forgetfulness that enables him to continue to function in his society and a forgetfulness that is dramatically interrupted by the creature's insistent remembering of his own animal existence. So similar instances of animal memories interrupting human narratives recur again and again throughout Shelley's writing. The novels that follow Frankenstein remain preoccupied with human forgetfulness of animal experience. And their close scrutiny of her early corpus in particular reveals an almost ever-present dialectic between forgotten and remembered animals. So throughout her writing, it becomes clear that human society is premised on an apparently necessary and inevitable forgetting of animal experience, and unbidden memories of animals serve as crucial interruptive moments, briefly disrupting the narrative trajectories of her characters. Yet while her characters seem to forget non-human animals with unusual regularity, the text of her work does not. Novels themselves are strikingly characterised by an apparent textual memory of animal beings. The recent work in literary memory studies has traced a long tradition in which memory is understood to play an essential role in the construction of human identity, with Susan Nalbandian noting how a remembering human subject is recognisable throughout Western literary history. This connection between human memory and human identity was particularly cemented throughout the 18th century, with John Locke suggesting in his influential Essay on Human Understanding that personal identity depends on how far any intelligent being can repeat the idea of any past action with the same consciousness it had of it at first. Obviously, the essay is published at the end of the 17th century, but it's incredibly influential on 18th century thought. And Francis Ferguson notes Locke's realization of the importance of memory for anchoring a sense of individual continuity over time. And she suggests that an intensification of attention to memory underwrote the phenomenal rise of literature in the centuries after Locke, and it became, she suggests, also increasingly individualised in the Romantic period, which is when Shelley's writing. So today I want to suggest that this remembering human subject is also frequently characterised by forgetfulness of non-human animals. Given how intimately human identity is bound up with human memory, it's understandable that animal memories can trouble a stable sense of human identity. Literary examples of forgetful human subjects reveal deep anxieties about developing understandings of human subjectivity and also call attention to the way that investment in individual human memory also involves forgetting of other beings. But beneath this surface emphasis on the memories of individual human subjects linger the forgotten memories of animals. And this dialectic between human forgetfulness and animal memory is something that Shelley explores in particular depths, I'd say, in her early novels in particular. So from Frankenstein, I now want to turn to The Last Man, which sits pretty much right in the middle of Shelley's writing career and is generally understood as marking a pretty major transition between her early writing and her later work. So just a disclaimer, I've used Frankenstein as the entry point, but from now on this will all be about The Last Man. So first published in 1826, The Last Man is a prophecy about the future narrated in the past tense, which I'll explain in a bit more depth in a moment. So it's set between the years 2073 and 2100, and it details the destruction of nearly the entire human race by a virulent plague. So it's been a great text to be working with in the last few years. The novel is narrated by the orphaned English nobleman Lionel Verney, and through a series of chance encounters, he becomes close friends with some of the most influential people in England, and that is something that he relates in the first novel. And then in the second two novels, he goes on to describe the fall of these illustrious families and, in fact, the fall of the entire human race to the plague. And he finds himself alone at the end of the novel, apparently the only human who has survived. Now, the anthropocentric forgetfulness modelled by Victor Frankenstein is generally shared by most of the protagonists in The Last Man. Throughout the novel, Shelley uses Lionel and his companions to model a number of human political systems, all of which are ultimately flawed. And there's been a lot of scholarship on these different modelings of how to structure human society and human politics. But in my work, I look at the way that each of these representatives are also characterised by a forgetfulness of animals. They each have at least one key moment where the way that they interact or fail to pay attention to an animal acts as a key signifier as to their later failing as a leader. But today I'm going to focus on an extended example of Lionel's own anthropocentric forgetfulness, which he describes in depth, so it works quite well to demonstrate how Shelley foregrounds this concern. And this scene is particularly significant because of how it captures memory and forgetfulness at the same time. So this occurs toward the end of the novel, which is when the plague's destruction of the human community is well underway. The inhabitants of England have decided that if they want to survive the plague, they need to leave England, and they're seeking warmer countries. And Lionel is somehow separated from his family during the journey. And so he realises that they've been detained in Versailles, and concerned for their safety, he decides to turn back and find them. And even though he's many miles away, he decides that he can get there in one night. So he saddles his horse. Even though this is set in the future, Shelley's not really that interested in exploring other modes of transportation. So still a lot of horses in 2075. And so he describes his ride through the night. "I spurred my horse, who addressed his free limbs to speed and tossed his gallant head in pride." So clearly here Lionel himself is taking pride in his horse's speed and power, and he describes this kind of animal pleasure in the strength and pace of this ride with his head bared to the rushing wind. But the irony of Lionel's reference to his horse's free limbs becomes clear when the horse becomes exhausted, and Lionel describes how, forgetful of his fatigue, "I cheered him with my voice and urged him with the spur." And clearly Lionel feels that his business is too urgent to stop and rest the horse, and he's reluctant to leave the horse somewhere and take another one, justifying this by saying that, "I did not wish to exchange him for any chance beast I might light on, leaving him never to be refound." And so Lionel's language here is quite equivocal. He kind of implies that the reason he doesn't want to leave the horse is because it's for the horse's welfare, leaving him never to be refound. But obviously, it's mostly himself that he's concerned. He doesn't want to lose his gallant and useful creature. But unfortunately, Lionel's horse is ultimately never to be refound by anyone, as he's so fatigued by the journey that he dies as soon as they reach the destination. So after describing their ride through the night, Lionel notes how the new day dawns and they approach Versailles. The horse realizes that they're getting closer, and he musters his flagging strength. He shot down the boulevard swift as an arrow. "Poor fellow, as I dismounted at the gate of the castle, he sunk on his knees. His eyes were covered with a film. He fell on his side and he died." And Lionel describes how he witnesses the horse's death with an anguish unaccountable even to myself. The spasm was as the wrenching of some limb in agonizing torture. This incomparable anguish is apparently very short-lived. In the very same sentence, Lionel notes that this grief was brief as it was intolerable, and goes on, "I forgot him as I swiftly darted through the open portal." After a momentary outpouring of deep grief about the animal whose death he is responsible for, Lionel forgets it entirely. He hears his friends' voices and runs into the castle to join them, and the horse is never mentioned again. So on the one hand, it's understandable that Lionel forgets the horse's exhaustion. He's concerned about his family during a pretty extreme apocalyptic event. The whole world is in chaos. The human population is being destroyed by a deadly plague. I really don't want to downplay the situation at hand. But I think at the same time, there are some really clear things that he could have done to ensure the animal's survival, which Lionel refers to himself. So Shelley makes sure to note that. And it's also important to remember that this example mirrors numerous earlier instances of similar forgetfulness displayed by characters during much more stable times in the novel. So in this rather extreme example, Shelley demonstrates how human society is premised on an apparently necessary forgetfulness of animal experience. And I think what's really interesting here is the way that the text describes the actual experience of remembering and then forgetting an animal, the dialectical movement between this moment of deep connection and sense, a real sense of the horse, to the moment of forgetting. And while the moment seems to last forever, the act of forgetting is really quick. So I think paying attention to Shelley's pacing is really key here. So in this sense, this scene is an example of what Teresa M. Kelly refers to as a micro disturbance. a moment that serves to briefly disrupt narratives of progress within Romantic period writing. And she describes such moments as incidences of accident, interruption, or regress that complicate Romantic thinking and writing about the future. So Kelly notes that although such moments do not ultimately change the course of events being narrated usually, they offer important opportunities to pay attention to a momentary swerve away from the main focus of the narrative. Briefly shifting attention away from this apparent inexorable progress of the prophecy of the destruction of the human race. And so she notes how such detours mark where something untoward or unexpected may enter as a matter of importance, drawing attention to how each moment has a force of its own and its impulse may be eruptive rather than sequential. The Last Man, of course, lends itself particularly well to such moments of digression, such counterparts, because built into the prophecy of this narrative is the recognition that the events being narrated could play out completely differently. And this is because of the way that Shelley introduces the novel with the fact that it's a prophecy. So the novel begins with a short introduction in which an unnamed narrator describes a visit to Naples in 1818. On this journey, they visit the cave of the Cumaean Sibyl, an unnamed companion. And it is here that they find piles of leaves and bark covered with writing in a number of different languages. And they take away with them a hasty selection of such as the leaves, whose writing at least one of us could understand, and spend the next several years deciphering some of the prophecy. So from the beginning of the text, it is clear that this is a compromised, imperfect, and unwhole document that we are about to read. The narrator goes on, scattered and unconnected as they were, I have been obliged to add links and model the work into a consistent form. And this short introduction ends with the narrator concluding that the merits of my adaptation and translation must decide how far I have well bestowed my time and imperfect powers in giving form and substance to the frail and attenuated leaves of the Sibyl. So this is the last sentence of the introduction, and the text that follows is the beginning of the novel as narrated by Lionel. So here from the very beginning, there's a sense that the way that this prophecy has been put together is imperfect, that it's a fallible document put together by someone with imperfect powers. And this labour that this narrator has gone into of piecing together future events is akin to the labour of reconfiguring the past that I'm interested in Shelley's work, in how we, by going back over the past, we can pay attention to brief moments that may interrupt the main trajectory of a novel or of a narrative. So there's a connection between the labour of remembering and the labour of prophecy. And this is a connection that has been drawn out in some depth by Karen Berard in their work on time and memory. So Berard is both a theoretical physicist and a professor of cultural studies, and they suggest that thinking about the future always involves a return to the past, a labour of piecing and re-piecing together past events that becomes necessary for moving forward. Human history telling never has total access to the past, so must constantly pull it apart and reform it to get closer and closer to what happened without ever actually arriving at a whole clear picture. So noting how questions of history, memory, and politics are all rooted in particular conceptions of time and being, Berard points out that thinking about the possibilities of justice to come must inevitably involve the tracing of entanglements of violent histories as an integral part of an embodied practice of remembering. This remembering of history is literalized in The Last Man because the history being recounted is a history of the future, a prophecy written in the past tense. Kelly suggests that romantic narratives of prophecy explore how some other outcome could have been possible, but such a difference would require an event that interrupts. And I'm interested in how animals and memories of animals can function as just such interruptions. So a really clear example of this occurs much earlier in the novel, before the plague kind of takes over the world. And this details something that happens with Lionel's friend, Raymond, who's briefly Lord Protector of England, and goes to fight with Greece in the war against Turkey. And all throughout the novel, Shelley hits obliquely at the connection between war and disease. There's always a sense that underlying the narrative, there's always a sense that there's a connection between the plague and human tyranny, even though she never overtly says as much. But there's always a sense of human responsibility for the spread of the plague. And this is particularly clear in the scenes of war that take up most of the first volume of the novel. And there's this really great moment when Raymond and all of his troops are standing outside the gates of Constantinople. They're about to enter the city to attack. And his horse pulls back and refuses to enter the gates. And at the same time, his dog lies down and supplicates and moans, which is interpreted as like a warning to not enter the city. But of course he does, he pushes the horse to enter and destruction ensues. So this is a really quite clear example of this kind of animal interruption that functions as an indicator that of a way that things could have gone differently. Yet there are other moments of interruption where the actual significance of the animal memory that has interrupted the path of the narrative remains unclear. So both the reader and the character who feels compelled to relate this moment, there's not really a clear path of interpretation for what that moment of interruption might mean. So from here, I want to jump to a moment that happens. It's about the end of the second volume of the novel. And this is just before Lionel and his companions decide that it will be necessary to leave England to survive the plague. And Lionel describes a brief interaction with a robin. So this happens one afternoon when he's feeling quite overwhelmed by everything that's happening. And so pushed on by restless, unsatisfying reflections, he goes for a short walk in the woods. He notes how a robin redbreast dropped from the frosty branches of the trees. Its panting breast and half-closed eyes showed that it was dying. A hawk appeared in the air and sudden fear seized the creature and it exerted its last strength. And so Lionel takes it up and he puts it in his jacket and he feeds it with a few crumbs from a biscuit and describes how by degrees it revived. And Lionel concludes this brief interlude with a slightly embarrassed reflection. I cannot tell why I detail this trifling incident, but the scene is still before me. And I suggest that this moment of self-reflexivity makes clear that, in fact, this maybe is not a trifling incident, but a key interruptive moment in Lionel's narrative. It comes right at the end of the second volume of the novel, so it's given a significant narrative position, and it marks a crucial moment in the text because it's immediately afterwards that Lionel and his companions decide to leave England. So for Lionel himself, the robin appears to function at least partly symbolically. Casting himself as a human saviour in the moment, the incident ultimately prompts his decision to step up his personal mission to save humanity. After describing the bird lying warm and safe in his shirt, Lionel goes on to reflect on his continuing desire to protect his wife, Idris, and their family, despite a growing sense of hopelessness. He notes his desire that my firm courage and cheerful exertions might shelter the dear mate, though the throbbings of my heart be replete with pain, still while your dear heart can repose in peace on that heart, my struggle shall not cease. So Lionel's description of the throbbings of his heart and his wife's heart beating against his own recall the robin's heart, which is literally beating against Lionel's chest under his shirt. So there's a strange interplay between Lionel's wife and the robin here. Lionel clearly sees himself as a protector of both. And his reference to your dear heart sounds oddly like he's speaking to the robin, given that it's the robin's heart that is actually beating against his own. So this experience of rescuing and protecting this fragile bird apparently inspires Lionel to return to the duty of protecting his own family with renewed vigour. And after recording this incident, he doesn't mention the robin again, and it's really unclear what happens to the bird. So the briefly remembered animal is forgotten, having served its symbolic function. But I think that there's a counter-reading under the surface of Lionel's interpretation of this incident. So while the scene certainly emphasises the fragility of both human and non-human life, I think that it works most thoughtfully on a non-metaphorical level. Lionel and the bird both share biological vulnerability, and this is a source of brief kinship for them. The encounter calls attention to the shared vulnerability of both human and animal bodies, undermining the belief in human exceptionalism that Lionel and his companions generally maintain throughout the novel. In this reading, I'm influenced by the work of Anat Pick, who suggests that there is a powerful antidote to anthropocentrism in writing that explores notions of embodiment and the shared vulnerability of all bodies. Now, while this scene doesn't change the destructive course of the novel, this prophesied doom that the narrative appears to be locked into, it just functions as a brief moment of both respite and hubris in which bodily vulnerability and human-animal connection is seen and paid attention to, just briefly. What Kelly calls a micro-disturbance, or what Lionel refers to as a trifling incident. So Lionel's very reflection that he cannot tell why he relates this incident cautions the reader to pay particular attention. The fact that Lionel doesn't know why he's describing this moment is a kind of clue suggesting that what is happening here is happening at a level above the narration. He's clearly not sure how to interpret the incident or why he records it, but he nevertheless emphasises that the scene is still before him. So Lionel's reference to the scene being still before him returns us for a moment to the present, forcing the reader to consider where Lionel is when he's having this reflection. This so-called trifling incident has clearly formed part of his future consciousness in which he's writing down the story. So what future present is this in which Lionel is writing down the narrative? Where does he end up and how is this final location positioned within the temporality of the novel? I'll tell you. After the death of all of his companions and apparently the rest of the human race, Lionel journeys to Rome on his own, where he spends a certain amount of time wandering around the ruins of human civilization, lamenting the relics of his lost species. And along the way, he befriends an animal, an old sheepdog, who is himself characterized by a capacity to remember in multiple ways. So Lionel finds the dog herding sheep, continuing to fill its remembered duties, even though his master has long since died. And Lionel describes this as a repetition of lessons learned from man, now useless, though unforgotten. And it's not only his duties that the dog remembers. Lionel describes the animal's excessive delight when they first come upon one another. He sprung up to my knees, wagging his tail with the short, quick bark of pleasure, and from that day has never neglected to watch by and attend on me. So clearly the dog's ecstatic recognition of Lionel indicates a memory of humankind and of his own interspecies companionship with past humans. And the novel ends with Lionel and the dog preparing to make another journey together, to seek other survivors, other possible companions, to see what the future holds for them both. This future-facing conclusion at the end of Lionel's narrative of his tragic experiences draws attention to a link between memory and imagination, how thinking about the past informs thinking about the future. Alan Richardson has drawn attention to the intimate connection between memory and imagination in British Romanticism. And he responds to this general understanding of the interrelationship between remembering and imagining as a fundamentally new idea by emphasising that, in fact, a close alliance between memory and imagination was a key element of 18th century thought. So this connection between memory and imagination obviously has important implications for thinking about the future. Richardson is particularly interested in a romantic preoccupation with the problem of misremembering. How misremembering the past can have negative impacts on future thinking because of misguided decisions made by people who got unrealistic understandings of what happened in the past. And he notes, it becomes evident that the imagination can prove not only redemptive but also potentially compromising and even hazardous, perhaps precisely because of its links to a memory system notoriously susceptible to distortion. So the forgotten animals that haunt Shelley's writing can be understood as a response to a collective anthropocentric misremembering that has characterised the societies that she describes. But the link between memory and imagination can also offer the potential for more positive ways forward. So building on Richardson's work, Sarah Eron has also noted the connection between memory and imagination in 18th century thought. But rather than focusing on the impact that memory has on thinking about the future, Eron concentrates on how this connection between memory and imagination can enable the reshaping of memory. So she notes that for the Enlightenment novelist, memory has the power to alter environments and things in the world. It can change our stories of the past. It can use stories to change present circumstances. And she suggests that in many 18th century novels, memory has a curious power to heal wounds and suture gaps. The healing powers of memory are carried further in The Last Man. By describing a future prophecy as if it has already happened, Shelley literalises the connection between memory and imagination, making the line between them most difficult to decipher. Lionel's recollection of the interaction with the robin that is still before him gestures to a possibility of how this retained memory might be reinterpreted by Lionel in the future, hinting at how our previous readings and misreadings of situations can change. Memories that have been buried and forgotten can resurface again to indicate new ways forward. And the connection between memory and imagination is key here because of how memories can be changed to build better futures. This obviously maps on to Berard's concept of remembering the past, returning again and again to past events and re-piecing together forgotten elements and what has been left out of our forever flawed and incomplete histories. It is only by a process of constant return that we can begin to move forward to a future of justice to come. Lionel's reference to the bird that is still before him suggests the possibility of a future to come better informed by animal memories of the past, memories of shared vulnerability, kinship across species, memories of connection across vast gulfs of otherness that might better equip us with all the future encounters with otherness that lie ahead. Eron notes how 18th century novelists use memory to both change our stories of the past and change present circumstances. In The Last Man, Shelley also uses memory to potentially change the future. So I want to close this paper with the final image from The Last Man, Lionel embarking on this ship with his canine companion to seek out further corners of the world, further kinds of companionship. The open-endedness of this scene gestures towards future possibilities as yet unseen by either text or reader, and there is a tentative positivity associated with this unknown future ahead. This future contains the possibility of worlds informed by more positive relationships between humans and others, possibilities perhaps at least partially formed by memories of animals.
Yeah, well done, Libby. Thank you. That was wonderful and so thought-provoking and well delivered too. So, yeah, I would love to hear your questions. I know that I have, Mara.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, first off, thank you, Libby. That was amazing. I've got so many things I'd like to say, but I will keep it very brief. A minute to share. All through that talk, I couldn't help thinking how, with this lovely kind of layering you've got of forgetfulness and remembering animals, humans, and future, and also so many of the examples you gave. And so there's this theme that comes to me then through all of that fragmentation. So, and of course, being across Alan Richardson's work particularly, I thought, do you think then that the fragmentation in the narrative arcs and as well as looking at the way memory works, so I think the most stunning thing I learned from Richardson was all through my study of memory and still is the idea that memory is actually not, we've always thought of it as, you know, it lets us down, it's unreliable and so on, but in fact if you think of it as cognitivists are starting to be very sure, as sure as they can be, that in fact it's a forward oriented mechanism. It's not a backward, which is, and it is designed in fact to be fragmentary, so that we can weave in this autobiographical fragmentation into the future, and be able to, as Shelley is doing, which is amazing that she is doing it. I'm just so impressed how she's kind of got this intuitive sense of all of this so long ago. Yeah, so sorry, that's not a clear question. That's just more of a long comment. But yes, I just wonder what if you want to say any more about that sort of fragmentary position of the narrative vis-a-vis memory.
Yeah, no, I love that you asked about that because I actually wanted to talk. There's so many things. It's really hard working with that fan because it is, I mean, apart from all the other stuff, it's just a massive book and there's so much in it. And I wanted to talk more about the prophecy because I think that the way she sets it up with that prophecy is so integral to everything that comes because it's described as fragments that even she doesn't even take away all of the fragments. They only take away some of the fragments. And the other thing that I didn't have enough time to go into is the way that in terms of memory and personal memory, the way that Shelley uses that introduction is very playful because the date that she says, I went to this cave of the Sibyl, was the date that she and Percy Shelley actually did go to the Bay of Naples and did, I think they did go to the cave. It's very funny because in their journal they talk about how disappointed they are with the Elysian fields and all of these special places. But she specifically dates it to the date that they went there. And so that introduction is always kind of read as being biographical. autobiography. But she's that person who's narrating it is never named. They're never given any biographical detail, and their companion isn't named either, and then neither of them are gendered. So it's very easy to read that as Mary and Percy, and she certainly is playing with that idea, but I think you have to be really careful with assuming that it's an autobiography, because obviously she didn't actually come away with all of these leaves. But in terms of, like, the idea of fragmentation as actually part of what's positive about memory, and actually, like what Ira talks about, part of what is healing about memory, I think it's really interesting looking at, you know, recent cognitive work, which I'm only scratching the surface. I know that you're the one who knows all about that. But, I mean, what's great about Richardson is that he's saying, look, you know, we've got all these new thoughts about this now, but clearly people were very much aware of that kind of the healing associated with the fact that we don't remember perfectly, that if we remembered perfectly, we could never move forward. And Eron does really build on that. She does really great work where she looks at slightly earlier texts, but her last text she looks at in her book is Jane Austen, so kind of contemporary. But she looks at Robinson Crusoe and how the way that he survives on the island is by drawing on memories, but that he has to change. And because of the way the novel's set up, you can see that he misremembers, but that's how he survives, is by kind of his muddled memories. And which is interesting because Robinson Crusoe is kind of, you know, it's often interpreted as it's all about everything's new and he has to survive in a completely new environment. But she looks at why he survives is actually because of things that have come before and his own kind of imperfect recollection of them. There's so many places one could go with that. But I think,
I'd like to jump off of that. The word I wrote down was also fragmented and it just jumped out. I really love how you've linked that to memory, to interruptions, and particularly to that that this kind of invisible haunting presence.
Mm.
And obviously fragmentation is a big gothic thing, and Shelley's very into the gothic. She's our original goth girl.
Yeah.
So I just wondered, are you engaging with that side of things?
Yeah.
But I like this idea of the gothic fragment as something that's always haunted by this sense of its incompleteness and what it could have been.
Yeah.
That sense of the missing, which is implicitly present then in this invisible way. So is that sort of...
Yeah, no, the gothic's a big part of what I do because my thesis is on Shelley and Wollstonecraft, and Wollstonecraft has this really kind of funny relationship with the gothic where she kind of hates it, but she also just constantly uses it. Mm-hmm. And so I look at, like, part of, I guess, what I'm trying to trace is this genealogy of, specifically, I guess, around memories of animals that you trace between Wollstonecraft and Shelley's writing. And there's sort of hints of things not ever expressly clear in Wollstonecraft's writing that Shelley really pulls out. And the Gothic, I think, is kind of the site where you can see that happening most clearly. So the kind of Wollstonecraft text that I work most with is Moriah, which is her weirdly gothic and anti-gothic novel. And the way that memories of animals turn up in that novel is really interesting. And then obviously Into Frankenstein, that the fact that at, you know, 18, Shelley writes this like just brazenly gothic novel, and the way that part of the way that the past informs the present in the gothic. I think that the way that happens along animal lines is really fascinating. And I mentioned to you already that I love your work on the horses. And I actually wanted to refer to it, but it's a bit different what happens in that horse ride. But I think there is also an interesting link there, and this sense that the kind of fusion between Lionel and the horse is very Kirsten does really great work on, you look at Sleepy Hollow and that kind of the headless horseman. And so obviously it's a completely different thing that's happening with Lionel and his horse, but this sense that there's this connection where it's not like a neat man horse separation. There's a sense that he goes there and he loves it. And then he, like, as soon as the horse dies, he's like, right, onto the next thing. And that's not the most kind of gothic-y aspect of The Last Man, but it is a very gothic novel. And I think the way that, yeah, animals work in that's really interesting. Yeah.
Briefly abuse my host privilege, and because I feel like I'm also in the same area here, just thinking about productive incompleteness of memories. You probably know Liz Dames's book, Amnesiac Selves.
I haven't looked into it deeply, but I have got it on the shelf.
Essentially, the way that we forget things is what allows us to construct a narrative in a self in the present.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just thinking about that moment where the horse and the dog try to derail the entrance to the city. Is there a sense in which animals need to be forgotten because they're associated with a kind of perhaps cyclical or natural time that is inimical to the idea of constructing a plot, a narrative in the first place? There's something going on there. And then just a very quick thing, which you should feel free to ignore if you want to. It strikes me that the revivification of the robin is kind of like a more positive echo of galvanism.
That's great.
Is it possible that that's partly what's going on in the line, tortured the living animal to animate the lifeless clay?
That's definitely a galvanism reference. And it's a funny line because he doesn't actually say that animals are part of the stitched together being, but that, and obviously in Frankenstein, Shelley never makes it clear how he manages to vivify human life. But so the way that animals are used in that whole experiment is very vague, but it's definitely, part of her reference to galvanism, I would say. But what you said before
about the cyclicality of
it's really great that you picked that up because I hadn't sort of thought about it in that moment, but it's something that comes up a lot in Valperga, which is the novel that she writes before The Last Man. She pretty much says that because that's a novel that's all about tyranny and war. And at one point in the novel, there's this kind of very beautiful passage where she talks about everything that's happening in springtime, and she just describes in depth everything that's happening in the world, all of the kind of moments that happen in spring as a part of the kind of cycle of nature. And then at the end, she's like, and this is the season when man goes to war. And it's just really like the kind of contrast there is really, really stark. And that's just thinking about that in terms of narrative is really fascinating because, like, I guess what I look at more is how, this is true of our lives, there's a certain necessary forgetfulness that we all engage in order to keep going, because everything that we do, comes from some kind of pain and suffering for somebody else, not everything. But I think that, this realization that we're all very aware of in the contemporary world is something that I think is just starting in the 18th century, this recognition that survival means someone else not surviving. And so that's kind of what I look at in terms of this human society being premised on a forgetfulness of animal being, and that these moments of memory interrupt that. But in terms of a narrative itself requiring that just to move on is really, I think that's really, really rich interplay there. So that's exciting.
Other questions?
I guess sort of related to that as well. You talked about like multi-sensory kind of like animal senses, non-human senses. Mm-hmm. Experience. Are there senses that are sort of privileged in the senses that in a non-human way that might be tied to this idea of like animal memory that is, which sort of senses are those?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's lots of different things. trying to think in terms of, so I look at that more in Frankenstein, and obviously I really kind of cut down the Frankenstein stuff for this this presentation. I think there's a real kind of sense. I mean, we know this ourselves with cognitive work, that things that can trigger memory are certainly often other senses that we don't necessarily pay as much attention to. And so just trying to think of a really good example from Shelley where like a sense of that kind of sensory experience of memory. I can't really think of one off the top of my head, but with Frankenstein, because Frankenstein is the novel that kind of has the experience of animal memory actually narrated in the first person, is where I would turn to for something like that. The way in her other novels, the way that she looks at, like, and so I'm always kind of stuck in this interplay between when human animals remember that other animals exist, and then the actual experience of an animal's memory, and we're all animals, we all remember things as animals, but the sense of an animal's memory in Shelley's other work is more, it's always something seen from the outside. So this sheepdog that remembers humankind, there's been like, there's so many different ways of interpreting what's going on, and Lionel doesn't spend a lot of time doing that himself. But thinking about what, and I've just started getting a little bit into cognitive work on animal memory, which is like definitely way over my head at the moment. But thinking about what it means that the dog remembers the existence of people and how it loves them. You know, there's so many different ways of interpreting what that is and how it's different to human memory, or if we can neatly say that experience is different to what we think is special about human memory, like episodic memory. And I think, you know, that's very open-ended in Shelley. But I think the fact that sheepdog has these kind of two quite distinctive ways of remembering is really important. And in terms of the sensory stuff, I'll keep thinking of that.
Any final questions for the...
Okay, thank you so much. That's really wonderful. Let's give her one more round of applause.